So imagine you're the most powerful man on Earth. You rule an empire that stretches from Spain to Syria. You've ended a century of civil wars. You've been declared a living god. Poets write hymns to you. Your face is on every coin.
Augustus Caesar, the first Roman emperor, the man who turned a republic into a monarchy and somehow convinced everyone it was their idea.
And one day, a messenger arrives at your palace with news from the northern frontier. Three of your legions, 15,000 men, have been destroyed. Not defeated, not routed, destroyed in the forests of Germania by a man you personally trained, promoted, and trusted.
And what does the most powerful man on Earth do? He loses his mind.
Suetonius, the Roman biographer, records what happened next. Increasi, our dead author, quotes it directly. Augustus often beat his head against the wall and exclaimed, "Quintilius Varus, give me back my legions."
For months, months, not a day, not a week, the Emperor of Rome wandered his palace for months, smashing his head against walls, screaming the name of a dead general. He refused to cut his hair. He refused to shave. He treated the anniversary of the battle as a day of mourning for the rest of his life.
And Dion Cassius gives us even more. He says Augustus rent his garments, tore his own clothes, and was in great affliction for the troops he had lost, and for terror respecting the Germans and the Gauls. Terror. The emperor who conquered the world was terrified.
And then when Augustus tried to raise a new army to respond, nobody would enlist. Roman citizens of military age just refused. He had to threaten them with confiscation of property. He had to execute some of them. He ended up drafting freed slaves and retired veterans. That's how broken Rome was after this battle.
The most powerful empire in human history reduced to press-ganging former slaves because one German walked three legions into a forest and none of them walked out. And it worked. It worked on Arminius's own brother. Creasy tells us, Roman refinements and dignities succeeded in denationalizing the brother, who assumed the Roman name of Flavius and adhered to Rome throughout all her wars against his country.
Flavius, the collaborator, the brother who chose Rome. We're going to come back to him. There's a scene later that is genuinely one of the most dramatic moments in the entire book.
But Arminius took everything Rome gave him and stayed loyal to something else. Creasy says he remained unbought by honors or wealth, uncorrupted by refinement or luxury.
He was a Roman citizen, a Roman knight. He'd served in the Roman armies. He dined with Roman generals. He spoke perfect Latin. He understood Roman military tactics, Roman logistics, Roman discipline from the inside.
And Creasy gives us the payoff line. He says Arminius earned from Rome's greatest historian, Tacitus, the title Liberat Haud Divie Germaniae, the undoubted liberator of Germany.
But here's what makes his decision so remarkable. Creasy lists every leader who tried to resist Rome before Arminius and failed. Hannibal, dead. Mithridates, dead. Viriathus, assassinated. Vercingetorix, led in triumph through Rome and then butchered in a dungeon.
Vercingetorix, the Gaulish leader who'd actually cut off Roman detachments and brought Caesar himself to the brink at Alesia. And the Romans paraded him through the streets and then strangled him in a cell. That's what Rome did to people who resisted.
And Arminius knew all of this. He wasn't fighting out of ignorance. Creasy makes this explicit. Arminius was no rude savage fighting out of mere animal instinct or an ignorance of the might of his adversary.
He knew exactly what he was up against. He knew what Rome did to rebels. And he chose to rebel anyway.
Now, the love story. Because there is a love story.
Thus Nelda.
There's a Cheriscan chief named Segestus, pro-Roman, a collaborator like Flavius, and his daughter, thus Nelda, is, Creasy says, preeminent among the noble maidens of Germany.
Arminius wants to marry her. Segestus says no, probably because he can see that Arminius is not as loyal to Rome as he pretends to be.
So what does Arminius do? He elopes with her. In the middle of planning the biggest military operation in Germanic history, he also finds time for a romantic getaway.
Priorities.
And Segestus, furious, goes to the Roman governor and accuses Arminius of two things. One, stealing his daughter. Two, planning treason against Rome.
Both of which are completely true.
Both completely true. But here's the thing. The Roman governor doesn't believe Segestus because the Roman governor is an idiot.
Quintilius Varus, the man whose name Augustus would be screaming for months.
Creasy's description of Varus is devastating. He calls him a man of the Roman upper class, educated, cultured, legally trained, but also cruel, corrupt, and catastrophically arrogant. He'd just come from governing Syria, where, as Creasy puts it, courage in man and virtue in woman had for centuries been unknown.
That's a savage line about Syria. Very Victorian. Very wrong. But the point Creasy is making is that Varus treated the Germans like he treated the Syrians, as subjects to be exploited. He held courts, he charged fees, he accepted bribes, he let his soldiers do whatever they wanted. And Creasy goes further. He says the Romans, quote, habitually indulged in those violations of the sanctity of the domestic shrine and those insults upon honor and modesty by which far less gallant spirits than those of our Teutonic ancestors have often been maddened into insurrection. He's saying the Romans were assaulting German women and that this was the spark. So you have Arminius, betrayed in love, his wife threatened. His people violated, his country occupied, sitting at dinner with the man responsible, smiling, playing the loyal vassal, waiting. For months, he sat at Varus's table, appeared at his courts, nodded along to his legal proceedings, and the whole time he was organizing a general uprising. And Segestus told Varus explicitly, this man is plotting against you. And Varus ignored him. The most expensive dinner invitation in Roman history.
Okay, so the plan. Arminius secretly tells the tribes near the Weser and the Ems to stage a revolt, a fake revolt, a local disturbance that would require the Roman governor's personal attention.
And Varus falls for it. He gathers his three legions, the 17th, the 18th, and the 19th, and marches east into the interior of Germany, towards the disturbance, with Arminius riding alongside him as his trusted guide.
Creasy gives us the army's strength. Three legions, A four switch, after allowing for detachments, cannot be estimated at less than 14,000 Roman infantry, plus 800 or 900 Roman cavalry, plus allied troops. Call it 20,000 men total.
And then, the detail that tells you Varus had no idea what was coming. He let his army be accompanied by a massive train of baggage wagons and camp followers. Wives, merchants, servants, as if they were relocating to a friendly province.
He brought the suburbs.
He brought a moving city into the deepest forest in Europe. And for the first part of the march, it was fine. Flat ground, open terrain, Roman roads. But then they reached the Teutoburg Forest.
And here Creasy quotes a German scholar, Dr. Plate, describing the landscape. A tableland intersected by numerous deep and narrow valleys, which in some places form small plains, surrounded by steep mountains and rocks, and only accessible by narrow defiles. All the valleys are traversed by rapid streams. The narrow defiles. The kettle of slaughter. The landscape itself remembers.
So the column enters the forest. 20,000 men, plus wagons, plus camp followers, strung out in a long line. The soil is sodden with rain. Trees have to be felled to make causeways through the marshes. The cavalry can't move. The infantry is struggling. And then
the rear guard is hit.
Missiles from the woods on both flanks. Javelins, spears, coming from everywhere. And Arminius's Germanic auxiliaries, who were supposedly fighting for Rome, desert in mass. They cross over to the other side.
The double agent drops the mask.
Varus tries to press forward. They hack through to a clearing and make camp for the night. Because that's what Romans do. Even when the world is ending, they dig a ditch and build a wall. Discipline to the last.
The next morning, they march again. And this is where Creasy uses a technique he borrowed from Tacitus. He describes a later battle between Arminius and the Roman general Cassicna, which had almost identical conditions, and uses Tacitus's own words to fill in the gaps. Because nobody survived the Varus battle to write it down.
Arminius lets them form up, lets them march out in order, doesn't attack the formation head on. He's too smart for that. He knows Roman legionaries in close order, with their javelins and short swords, are nearly unbeatable.
So he waits. He lets the terrain do the work.
Rain. Torrential rain. Creasy says it was as if the angry gods of Germany were pouring out the vials of their wrath upon the invaders. The column approaches a ridge covered in forest, and Arminius has built barricades of felled trees across the path.
And now it starts to fall apart. Soldiers abandon the baggage wagons. Men crowd around trying to save their personal property. Nobody listens to orders. The line stretches and breaks.
And then Arminius gives the signal. The fierce shouts of the Germans pealed through the gloom of the forests, and in thronging multitudes they assailed the flanks of the invaders.
Creasy says Arminius and his men targeted the horses specifically. The wounded animals slipped in the mud and their own blood, threw their riders, and plunged into the ranks of the infantry, breaking formations.
Varus orders a retreat towards the nearest Roman garrison on the Lippi, but retreat is impossible. The Roman cavalry commander, Numonius Valla, panics. He rides off with his squadrons, abandoning the infantry. They're hunted down and killed to the last man. And then, Varus. Varus is badly wounded in a German charge. And rather than be captured, rather than be led in chains through a dramatic village, a Roman general, humiliated, he falls on his sword.
One lieutenant general falls fighting, the other surrenders. The ones who surrender, Creasy says mercy to a fallen foe had never been a Roman virtue. The Germans returned what they'd received. Those who weren't killed on the spot were sacrificed at altars in sacred groves.
And the bulk of the army? Creasy writes, two of the eagles captured, and the Roman host, which on the yester morning had marched forth in such pride and might, now broken up into confused fragments, either fell fighting beneath the overpowering numbers of the enemy, or perished in the swamps and woods in unavailing efforts at flight.
Few, very few, ever saw again the left bank of the Rhine.
There's one last stand. A group of veterans forms a ring on a small mound and fights off every charge for the rest of the day. Creasy says the traces of a feeble attempt at forming a ditch and mound were visible for years afterward. A ring of disturbed earth on a hill in the forest. The last heartbeat of three legions.
The next morning, the Germans overwhelm them. Some are killed on the spot. Others are taken to the sacred groves and sacrificed.
Creasy quotes Tacitus. Lucis propinquis barbari ara,
apus quas tribunos ac primorum ordinem centurionis macturinant. In the nearby sacred groves were barbarian altars, at which they had sacrificed the tribunes and centurions.
And just like that, three legions ceased to exist. The 17th, 18th, and 19th. Gone. And Rome never used those numbers again.
Never. 2,000 years of military history after this, and no Roman army was ever numbered 17, 18, or 19. They retired the jerseys.
That's how deep the trauma ran. Like how the Yankees retired Lou Gehrig's number 4. Except this isn't honoring a hero. This is warding off a curse.
But first, the brother scene. Because we promised and we need to deliver.
Yes, okay. So this happens a few years after the Varus battle. Germanicus, the Roman general, not a generic German, has marched into Germany to avenge the defeat. And the two armies are facing each other across the river Weser.
And Arminius is on the east bank. And he calls out across the river. He wants to see his brother.
Flavius. The brother who chose Rome. The brother who took a Roman name and fought in Roman armies against his own people.
Flavius steps forward. The archers are pulled back from both banks. And the two brothers, who haven't seen each other in years, start talking across the river. And Arminius asks about the scar. Flavius had lost an eye in a battle. Arminius asks him, "What battle? What did you get for it?" And Flavius shows him his Roman military decorations, his collar, his medals, his increased pay. He's showing off his bling to his brother across a river while their armies watch. And Arminius says, "Those are badges of slavery." And then it escalates. Flavius starts talking about the greatness of Rome. Arminius appeals to him. In the name of their country's gods, of the mother that had borne them, and by the holy names of fatherland and freedom, not to prefer being the betrayer to being the champion of his country. And then they start threatening each other. Flavius calls for his horse and sword so he can ride across the river and fight his own brother. A Roman general, Stertinius, has to physically restrain him. And Creasy includes the prod poem about this scene. And the lines that got me are these. "O misery that such a ban on such a brow should be. Why comes he not in battle's van, his country's chief to be? Why can't you be who you were supposed to be?" And then the kicker. "But it is past, where heroes press and cowards bend the knee. Arminius is not brotherless. His brethren are the free." His brethren are the free. His biological brother chose slavery in Roman silk. So Arminius adopted an entire nation as his family instead. And remember, while this scene is happening, Arminius's wife Thusnelda is a prisoner in Italy, pregnant when she was captured. Segestus, her own father, handed her over to Germanicus as revenge for the elopement. Her father betrayed her, turned her over to the enemy, while she was carrying Arminius's child. And the child, Tumellicus, was born in captivity. At the age of 4, he was led through the streets of Rome in a triumphal parade. A trophy. Tacitus says his life was eventful and unhappy. But the part of the annals that would have told us what happened to him is lost.
So Arminius has lost everything. His wife, his unborn child, his brother, and he's still fighting.
Tacitus says Arminius was goaded almost into frenzy by these losses, and he used them. He turned personal grief into political fuel. The fate of his wife, thus torn from him, and of his babe, doomed to bondage even before its birth, inflamed the eloquent invectives with which he roused his countrymen.
And then, 5 years after the great victory, Arminius is murdered by his own people at the age of 37.
His own kinsmen conspired against him. Tacitus says it was because he was trying to make himself king, but Creasy, and modern historians agree, thinks Tacitus misunderstood. Arminius was probably trying to extend his authority as an elected war chief, and rival factions within his own tribe saw that as a threat.
His father-in-law was a traitor. His brother was a traitor. His wife was kidnapped. His son was enslaved. And then his own cousins killed him.
At 37, the same age as Alexander the Great when he died. Except Alexander died at the height of his power, and Arminius died betrayed by the people he'd saved.
Okay, fact check time. Let's do the modern autopsy.
First, the big one. They found the battlefield.
In 1987, a British army officer named Tony Klun, Major Klun, was stationed in Osnabrück, Germany. He was an amateur metal detectorist, weekend hobby, and he went out to a hill called Kalkreis with his detector and found 162 Roman silver coins and 3 lead sling bullets.
And every single coin dated to before 980, not a single one after. The coins stopped at the exact year of the battle.
That triggered a full archaeological excavation starting in 1989, and they found everything. 5,000 to 6,000 Roman artifacts, spearheads, fragments of legionary sandals, horse equipment, sling bullets with legion marks on them, bones.
And the face mask.
A Roman cavalry face mask, iron, coated in silver. A human face with closed eyes, calm, almost serene, found in the mud where it had lain for nearly 2,000 years.
Think about that. A Roman officer strapped that mask to his helmet one morning in September 980, and nearly 2,000 years later, someone pulled it out of the same mud where he died.
There's now a museum at Kalkreis, the Kalkreis Museum and Park. You can walk the actual ground where 3 legions were destroyed.
And then the place names. Creasy was right about those. The Bone Lane, the Kettle of Slaughter, the Field of Victory. The landscape recorded the battle in German place names that survived for 2 millennia.
Now, the Hermann Monument, the Hermannsdenkmal. This is interesting because Creasy actually writes about it in 1851 as something that's being built. He says the statue would be 80 feet from the base to the point of the sword and would stand on a circular Gothic temple 90 feet high.
And then, this is heartbreaking and hilarious, he says the statue has been cast at the copperworks at Lemgo, but is just lying there, in disjointed fragments, exposed to the mutilating homage of relic-seeking travelers. They'd made the statue, but couldn't afford to put it up.
The statue of Germany's greatest hero was crowdfunded, and they ran out of money.
It wasn't completed until 1875, 24 years after Creasy's book. And when they finally put it up, the total height was 53 meters. That's about 175 feet. The statue itself is about 87 feet, including the sword.
87 feet. For context, the Statue of Liberty is 151 feet. So Hermann is more than half the size of Lady Liberty, standing on a forested hilltop in northern Germany, sword raised, pointing towards France.
Towards France, not towards Italy. Because by 1875, Germany's enemy was France, not Rome.
And then the awkward part, the Nazis.
Yeah. Hitler visited the monument in 1926. After 1930, the local Nazi party used it for rallies. In 1933, the Detmold government tried to have it declared the official pilgrimage site of the German nation.
Berlin said no, not because they disagreed with the symbolism, but because the transport links were bad.
The Nazis rejected it for logistics reasons. We love the nationalism, but the parking situation is impossible.
They held smaller events there in 35 and 41, glorifying Hitler as, quote, the successor of Arminius, which is deeply ironic because Arminius fought against a centralizing imperial power. He was the opposite of a fascist dictator. Post-war, the monument has been reclaimed as a general heritage site, but there's always that shadow. You can't build a monument to ethnic nationalism in Germany and not have it get co-opted by the worst people in history. Now, pop culture. Barbarians on Netflix, 2020. 2 seasons, 12 episodes.
Lawrence Rupp as Arminius, Jean Gorsad as the Snelda, David Shutter as a fictional character called Fulquin Wolfspear.
And the smartest thing they did? The Romans speak Latin, not English with a posh accent. Actual Latin, and the Germanic characters speak German, so you have this constant code switching that makes the cultural divide visceral.
IMDb has it around 7.1. The finale, the actual battle episode, scored an 8.1. It was canceled after season 2, which covers the Germanicus campaigns.
Historical accuracy mixed. The core events are solid. Arminius's dual identity, Varus's arrogance, the ambush. But they add a love triangle with the invented Fulquin character, and they give the Snelda a warrior queen arc that has no historical basis.
Though honestly, given that the Snelda eloped with a rebel leader against her father's wishes, and was later described by Tacitus as showing more of the spirit of her husband than of her father, the warrior queen vibe isn't a huge stretch.
And I, Claudius, the BBC, 1976, Brian Blessed as Augustus.
Brian Blessed, the man whose normal speaking voice is a foghorn. He plays Augustus receiving the news of the Teutoburg Forest, and he screams, "Quintilius Varus, where are my eagles?" And it is magnificent.
He doesn't just yell it. He becomes Augustus having a breakdown. It's one of the most famous scenes in British television history, and it's based directly on Suetonius.
Now, the gladiator connection. Ridley Scott's Gladiator opens with Roman legions fighting Germanic tribes in the forests of Germania. That's set in 180 AD, 171 years after the Teutoburg Forest, and the Romans are still fighting the same war.
Which actually proves Creasy's point. Arminius stopped Rome at the Rhine in 9 AD. 170 years later, Marcus Aurelius is still trying to push that frontier forward, and failing.
And gamers, Total War Rome 2 includes the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest as a playable historical scenario. You command the Germanic tribes, ambush the Roman column in the forest. It features the game's line of sight system, so you're literally hiding in trees waiting for legionaries to walk past.
They also added giant flaming hay bales, which is not historically attested, but is very fun.
Creative Assembly adding fireballs to everything.
Okay, the big claim, Creasy's argument.
And this one is bold. This might be the boldest claim in the entire book. Here's what Creasy says. Had Arminius been supine or unsuccessful, our Germanic ancestors would have been enslaved or exterminated in their original seats along the Eider and the Elbe. This island would never have borne the name of England, and we, this great English nation whose race and language are now overrunning the earth from one end of it to another, would have been utterly cut off from existence.
Sure, let me just unpack that. Creasy is saying if Arminius had lost, there would be no England, no English language, no English people, because the Germanic tribes that later became the Anglo-Saxons would have been Romanized or destroyed, and they never would have crossed the North Sea to Britain in the 5th century.
It's a causal chain. Arminius wins in 9 AD. Germania stays free. 400 years later, when Rome collapses, free Germanic tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, cross to Britain and become us, the English.
Is it true?
It's actually kind of true and kind of insane.
Both at once.
The linguistic argument is solid. English is a Germanic language, not a Romance language. If the Germanic tribes had been Romanized the way the Gauls were, those tribes would have spoken a Latin-based language, and there would have been no Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain. Or if there was one, it would have been by Romanized people speaking a form of Latin. We'd be speaking something closer to French.
Creasy actually goes further. He says, Arminius is far more truly one of our national heroes than Caractacus, Caractacus being the British chief who resisted Rome. Creasy is saying, the guy who fought in Germany matters more to English identity than the guy who fought in England.
And the philological evidence supports this. Creasy cites Dr. Robert Gordon Latham, who showed that the Cherusci, Arminius's tribe, were Old Saxons, and that the Anglo-Saxons of the coast were their closest relatives. And the Old Saxons were later almost exterminated by Charlemagne, while the Anglo-Saxons had already left for Britain.
So the English are, in a sense, the surviving branch of Arminius's people.
Now, the stretch. The huge stretch. Is it certain that Rome would have conquered all of Germania if Arminius had lost? No, probably not. The terrain was terrible, the logistics were impossible, Augustus himself had recommended his successors stick to the Rhine. Other Germanic revolts might have succeeded even without Arminius.
But the Teutoburg Forest was the moment Rome stopped. Creasy says, that victory secured at once and forever the independence of the Teutonic race.
And he's right about the aftermath. The Romans sent armies back into Germany. Germanicus fought several campaigns, but they never seriously tried to hold territory beyond the Rhine again. Creasy says, Roman fear disguised itself under the specious title of moderation.
We're not retreating, we're being strategic.
And here's what I find most moving about this chapter. Creasy ends with the fate of Arminius's memory. He says the Germans didn't write history. He says his countrymen made history, but did not write it. But his name survived in their songs. Tacitus, writing decades later, says, Canator et hoc barbarus apod gentes. He is still sung of among the barbarian nations.
Still sung of. A century after his death, the bards were still singing about Arminius. And then his memory grew into something divine. The Irminsul, the Column of Hermann, became a sacred object for the Old Saxons. They thought Charlemagne to defend it.
And Creasy traces it all the way to England.
One of the four great Anglo-Saxon highways was called the Earman Street, named after the deified Arminius in England.
So the man who saved Germania in 9 AD was being worshipped as a god by his descendants in England 1,000 years later, and they named a road after him.
Which is the most English tribute possible. We don't build a monument, we name a road.
Classic.
Okay, verdict time. Creasy's claim, the Battle of the Teutoburg Forest is a decisive battle that changed the course of civilization. His argument, Arminius saved Germanic independence, which preserved the culture and people that would eventually create England, France, and modern Europe. Without him, Rome absorbs Germania, and the 5th century migrations never happen.
My vote. Keep. And I'll say why. First, the battle itself is one of the most perfectly executed ambushes in military history. A double agent leads 3 legions into a forest and destroys them all. The aftermath is confirmed by Suetonius, Tacitus, Dion Cassius, and by actual archaeology at Calcrese. The retired legion numbers alone tell you how deep the wound went.
Second, Arminius as a character, his story is Shakespearean. Trained by the enemy, fights for freedom, loses his wife, loses his child, watches his brother choose the other side, wins the greatest battle of his era, and is murdered by his own people at 37. Tacitus calls him the undoubted liberator of Germany. That's the enemy's historian calling him a hero. When your opponent's press corps gives you a standing ovation, you've earned it.
Third, the England claim. Yes, it's a reach. Creasy couldn't know whether Rome would have conquered all of Germania, but the linguistic argument is real. English is Germanic. The Anglo-Saxons were Germanic. And the reason those tribes were free to migrate in the 5th century is because they'd never been conquered by Rome. Arminius didn't create England, but he created the conditions that made England possible.
Keep. With a note, the chapter has some of the worst Victorian Our Teutonic Ancestors framing in the whole book. Creasy is clearly writing as a man who believes Germanic blood is a real thing that matters. But strip away the racial framing and you've got a chapter that does 3 things brilliantly. It tells a spy thriller, it delivers a genuine tragedy, and it makes a historical argument that, while overstated, has a real kernel of truth.
That's 6 for 6 on the season. We still haven't cut anything.
We really are getting soft. Something has to give soon.
And speaking of things giving way, episode 5, The Battle of Chalons, 451 AD. Attila the Hun versus, basically, everyone else.
And this one has my favorite detail in the entire book. Before the battle, Attila builds a funeral pyre out of saddles, a mountain of cavalry saddles, drenched in oil. And he announces that if he loses, he will throw himself onto the pyre and burn rather than be captured.
A funeral pyre of saddles. That's either the most dramatic thing in military history or the most wasteful bonfire ever.
Attila and Chalons, next time on the Dead Authors Club.
We read books by dead authors, so you don't have to.
Quintilia Vare, Legiones Rede.
Give me back my legions.